Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. It's good to see you all. And speaking of Senator Jack LaValle, Jack LaValle and the Tampa Bay Times have a love-hate relationship. We love him and he hates us. Well, here we are. It's May, and a lot of unfinished business in Tallahassee. You're seeing government in action. Inaction is one word. Let's kind of take stock of where we are here, because it'll be now at least the middle of June before the state gets a budget. We've had Senator Tom Lee, who's been through many special sessions and is a veteran of a lot of stuff in Tallahassee. We've had Tom Lee calling the atmosphere up there toxic. We've had racist tweets about the members of the legislative black caucus. We've had the House shutting down 3 days early, and the Florida Supreme Court saying, you can't do that, it's unconstitutional, but there's really no remedy, so there's really nothing they can do. Don't let it happen again. I have a piece in the Times this weekend about sort of the history of special sessions, because there have been a lot of them, and many of them end badly. If there isn't a real concerted effort by legislative leaders to sort of bury the hatchet and realize we've got to find common ground here somewhere. I'll give you a couple of quick reminders that you might remember. There was the one-day special session a few years ago when Charlie Crist wanted a constitutional amendment to ban offshore oil drilling. And the leadership of the House said, Charlie Crist, you can go to hell. And they shut the thing down after 2 hours, and it didn't happen. When Bush was governor, Jeb Bush, we had three successive special sessions on medical malpractice. And I remember the story well. We had a young reporter was at Sun City Center. And he said, hey, Steve, he said, Jeb Bush was just here criticizing Republican senators for not towing the line on medical malpractice. Is that a story? I said, well, it's probably only a story if he named names. And this guy said, no, he named a whole lot of names. Mike Bennett, Todd Lee, I forget the other, Dennis Jones, maybe. This is 12 years ago, so you have different people in the Senate. So there's that. Former Governor Bob Martinez insisted on a special session to enact abortion restrictions in 1989. And it ended really badly because there was just no consensus on how to approach it. And it's let's face it, it's a divisive social issue for a lot of people. And so there's really, you're really on thin ice calling a special session without having some sort of a framework to work things out. Having said that, eventually they get it done. They get it accomplished. In 1992, they went down to the very last hour of the fiscal year with no budget, and the governor's office, Horton Childs, actually did a whole plan to, in effect, shut down non-essential services in state government. I mean, which parks stay open, which parks stay closed. The restaurant inspectors, are they frontline state workers? Obviously, you can't shut down prisons and things like that. But it backfired, and you had people walking around Tallahassee because the Childs people split the state workforce into two categories, essential and non-essential. We had people walking around Tallahassee saying, I'm a non-essential state employee. So it's not easy stuff to handle, but you know, the legislature is going to have to get it done. The breakdown that we're seeing here, of course, it involves health care policy and Medicaid expansion and the low-income pool, but I see it as political, philosophical, and institutional. Let me briefly say what I mean by that. Political in the sense that you've got a serious breach and difference of opinion between Republicans on health care policy. Philosophical, it's obvious. The Senate is a more pragmatic body with more experienced legislators for the most part, much less ideological. And there's bipartisan harmony between senators, regardless of their party affiliation. The House is much more rigid in its approach to things generally. The members are less experienced, and there's a really visceral, you see it in the comments by Richard Corbin and others, there's a visceral hatred of the federal government. Not just about health care, but everything. And institutional. And this is a point I hope will stay with you. the conflicts between the House and Senate, you know, make for good copy in my newspaper. It doesn't make for good government, but it is not entirely a bad thing. I know it comes off a lot of times in the papers as they're at loggerheads, they can't get their work done, they should be ashamed of themselves, all stuff. You're going to have a clash of philosophies and views, and it's going to need time to work itself out. I made a big mistake as a young reporter a long time ago. I've been covering the legislature since 1988. And I made the big mistake when I was working with the Miami Herald of advocating a column and making the point, you know what, 60 days in a state this size is a joke, a session that short. By the way, it isn't 60 days, it's 60 calendar days. It ends up being about 35 days in a state with 20 million people. And would I advocate the year-round legislature? No. The sand goes out of the hourglass real fast. And before you know it, the bell rings and it's not done. I found a comment from former House Speaker T.K. Wetherill, who was in charge when the budget blew up in 1992 when they had these non-essential and essential state employees. And Wetherill liked to speak his mind, still around, a former president of FSU. He said, you know how this system works around here. Until it blows up three or four times, nothing happens. There's a lot of truth to that. It's a totally human endeavor. There's a test of wills going on constantly. Under the radar, House members are running around conducting a whisper campaign and saying this Senate insistence on a modified form of Medicaid expansion that has nothing to do with helping poor people. It's because you've got senators who work for hospitals. The story's been written about a little bit. There's half a dozen senators who do have a professional tie to a hospital. Senator Aaron Dean works at Shands. Senator Amy Gardner, the Senate President, works for a hospital in Orlando. The hospital industry spreads a lot of money around to people of all parties, House and Senate, and the governor's office. So, that's a factor. I want to talk for a minute about the role of the governor here because I don't think it's been very pretty. He's had people in his own party in the legislature kind of, shooting at him a little bit. He's ill at ease in dealing with legislators because it has to do with his background as a CEO, not having a career in politics. A lot of folks think that may be a good thing. But he seems unable and unwilling to deal with legislators in a proactive way, to try to sit down, broker a compromise, get a resolution somehow. Jeb Bush had to do this a lot of times it backfired. But there would come a moment when Jeb Bush would say to you, Mr. Speaker, you, Mr. Senate President, meet me in my office in 15 minutes. Now, that was a public meeting, and everything would be hashed out. That's something that probably should be happening more. We're coming into the 20th year of Republicans having complete control over the legislative and executive branch of government. And there's growing pains here, but it's got to be pointed out that the Democrats did this same kind of stuff when they were in charge and worse. And, when you play chicken up to the end of the fiscal year, as they did in 1992, that's a complete breakdown of responsible leadership. And if Gardner and Chris Lee and Rick Scott don't fix this budget situation, it could happen. I think they're well aware of the risks involved, and they know exactly what they're doing. Before I take your questions, I do want to say that things could be a lot worse. Gary Morbino is a friend of mine, and a friend of probably some of you in this room. He sends me news articles that catches on. And I don't even see the headline, but I'll explain it. Here's the headline from the Miami Herald, 1954. Legislator is shot, false teeth blamed. I love the story because it tells you so much about the state of Florida in 1954. This guy is a House member from Martin County. He's on his way back from the capital to the district. How's he traveling? By train. He traveled by train back in those days. The train stops in the little town of Lloyd outside of Tallahassee. And the train stops so suddenly, his false teeth popped out of his mouth, out of the ground. And I'm looking for him. He ended up in somebody's backyard. He was mistaken for a prowler and he got shot. That's what can happen. And I'll just close by, before I take the questions, by saying, you know, that these folks have to work with each other and get along with each other. They don't have to agree, and it's good that they don't agree, as I pointed out a minute ago. But we're in another interesting moment here. We're going to end the session in mid and late June, and they're going to be back there in 6 months in an election year for many of them. They made a decision last year to start the 2016 session in January, right after the holidays. And so this is an extremely short recess, not only between a regular and special session, but very unusual to have this short period of time between the end of a special session and the start of the next regular session. And, you know, people have political ambitions and so forth, and next year is an election year for most people in the legislature. So, you know, they're going to have to find a middle ground where everyone can save face and feel they walked away with something. And as has been pointed out by a number of people, you know, most senators have been through many special sessions. Most House members have never been through one ever. And so that's, again, why it's important to have this framework for a dialogue before they get up there. Rick Scott has been making noise about him calling a special session. And the senators I talk to, they're aghast at the idea. You don't want to do that. You want to stay out of that and let the legislature try to work this out amongst themselves. And again, it could be uglier than it's been so far, but history tells us they'll fix it by June 30th. So with that, I'd be happy to take your questions.
Okay, ready for questions. I just want to remind you, 45 seconds. Please state your name clearly so the timer so the bang and claw ringers can hear you. And go for it. Hi, Steve. I'm Corey Adler.
Yes.
So during the campaign process, the folks come out, they talk to us, they seem like they're reasonable, they seem like they're approachable, and they're sane. And then about 6 months later, they come home, and they're not sane anymore. So what do you think happens? Do you think that they all along knew that this was, that they were never going to play well with their other legislators? Did they walk into the legislative session and get strong-armed into becoming people that they never intended? What happens to them? And what can we do as voters to make sure that they have counseling? Or, you know, what do we do?
Any smart legislator is basically the same person back home as they are in Tallahassee. It's not always the case. Your question gets to the heart of one of the biggest problems in Tallahassee, and that's term limits. There's probably no undoing what term limits has done to the state, because House members are perpetually running for office, and they're running for Speaker before they've cast their first vote. So that's the short answer to your question. I have a proposal, an idea, and that would be to stretch term limits to 12 years. House members would serve 3 4-year terms. Senators would serve 2 6-year terms. Yes, you elect a senator from Pinellas County, and he or she is going up for 6 years, just like they do in the United States Senate. Why would that would encourage them not to be having one, they got one hand on the voting button and the other hand on the political calendar back home. You need to create some distance between those two things to get more responsible government. And I'm telling you, the House members get sworn in at an organizational session, and they've got a fundraiser that night. You're never going to take money out of the process, but it's gotten bigger and exponentially worse in the time I've been in Tallahassee. Yes, sir.
Bob Safransky, who was the most effective state legislator from Pinellas County, and who was the least effective in this session?
I'll answer the easy part of the question first. Who was the least effective? It'd be one of your younger Republicans in the House delegation. You know, is this my opportunity to pick on Larry Ahern? I mean, it's to get back to your question too, ma'am, House members, you stick a microphone in their face and say, how are you voting on the online voter registration bill? How are you voting on the low-grade medical marijuana bill? And they'll look you right in the eye and say, I got to check with leadership. What? Check with leadership? Again, the toxic nature of what's happening to the floor of the House. I mean, a senator wouldn't say that in a million years. Let me check with Andy Gardner before I tell you how I'm voting on it. And that's why you still have in the Senate, to me, a sign of good government. I'm not interested in what the issue is, but the point is, if you look at the board, the vote is 22 to 18, 21 to 19. It doesn't happen a lot, but it does happen. That's Florida. That's the kind of place Florida is. You're going to have close calls. The most effective legislator from Pinellas County in this session, I would say Representative Chris Landau. Well, you know, I'm not saying it because Jack is here. I've covered him for a very long time, but there's no substitute for just you know, working issues and being knowledgeable. And you know, the guy carries a tremendous load of legislation. But you've got other good legislators in Pinellas County, and you've got the benefit of having Lee in the Senate. I think experience really matters. I spoke to one of your beachfront chamber groups during the session, and you know, there's been an interesting and well-documented history of Pinellas County sending to Tallahassee people like Pete Dunbar, Sandy Safley, Kurt Kaiser. I mean, all solid, competent legislators who called them as they saw them, rather than voting some card from from some interest group. Yes, in the back.
Betty Morgan Steve. In this special session that's coming up, they said that the thing that really will be addressed is the budget. And they are going to ignore all of these other bills that were suggested and weren't picked. In many cases, isn't that a really good thing?
Well, yes. I mean, it is a good thing. There's been stories in the last couple of days that they passed like 260-some-odd bills. I don't have the exact number. Which is the fewest passed, you know, in recent sessions. And, of course, a lot of people, especially Republicans, 260? We need that many new laws? I mean, because a typical session will pass 500. Yes, the answer is yes, it's good to keep the focus narrow. The problem is the budget is not a very narrow subject. You can put almost any subject under the sun and rationalize it as an issue of the budget. For example, I'll give you just one example. We have an incredibly horrible situation in the state prison system. Some of the problems in the state prison system can only be addressed, or should be addressed, with money. And so they're going to do a budget. But the budget is both a policy guide for what the state thinks are priorities, but it's inherently a political statement. And so that's why what they've done is they've left not only some important work until the end of June, they've left the most important thing they do, which is doing the budget. That.
Ben Diner. Steve, thank you for coming. As you know, Florida has an important tradition of carrying out the public business in the sunshine. And since Governor Scott has been elected, I understand that his office has been sued for not complying with the public records laws with regard to emails, and the cabinet has been sued for not following the sunshine laws and the termination of a state agency head. As a longtime observer and member of the press corps in Tallahassee, how would you characterize Governor Scott and his office's compliance with our sunshine laws?
I give a pretty low grade. I mean, it would not be a passing grade. It's a D or an F. I mean, they do, by the way, they do what they are legally required to. They do comply with public records requests, but it takes an awfully long time to get them. And you're right. There's a serious question about access. Someone like me relies on the ability to talk to people on a regular basis about what they're doing, whether it appears in a news story or not. A lot of moving parts up there. But again, it's the governor's private sector background and a lack of experience, and maybe it's a cultural lack of awareness that, hey, you know, this meeting, this discussion, we got to do it in public. The day before the session started, Rick Scott invites Andy Gardner to have lunch at the governor's bench. That's a legally noticed meeting. The press shows up, we stand in the corner. We're not eating, we're just standing there watching and listening. And they start a little bit of small talk. How are your grandchildren? How are your kids? How's the weather? Have you been going fishing lately? And I said to the local reporter, I said, just wait a few minutes. They'll get them out of talking serious policy stuff. They talk for an hour and a half, and Rick Scott never brought up anything substantive, ever. The whole lunch was about my grandkids, the ball team, you know, what are you doing next weekend? So you can't just have a public meeting. You're going to have a public meeting where somebody's talking about serious stuff. We need both. Yes, ma'am. You.
Hi, my name is Susan Costa, and I've been impressed by the way that Rick Scott, I originally thought, yeah, he's a business guy, this is how he does things in business, he doesn't know better, but then I found out he's actually an attorney. He actually understands the law, and I have this feeling that, I mean, with my personal view, he seems contemptuous of it, and that seems to explain what he does. I'm just wondering what you think of that.
Well, I would not say he's contemptuous of the law. You're talking about a government who just sued the Obama administration. What's interesting is that a guy who, like a lot of Republicans, would favor tort reform, and not think that litigation is the best way to solve civil disputes, he's oftentimes the guy rushing to the courthouse. I also think that you need people with experience. You need a mix. Most of the people around Rick Scott in the governor's office are very young and very new to Florida. Early on, when Jeb Bush was governor, people would walk the halls of Tallahassee legislators and say, "Damn it, Jeb, you need some gray hair in that office." That was the expression. Well, and he went and hired a guy who's widely admired in Tallahassee, who's recently passed away. He hired Ken Plant, who was a former state legislative senator and became a lobbyist, but who was highly regarded for just even-handed, knowledgeable, didn't go around picking fights with people, would find a way to work things out in an amicable way. And I think Rick Scott desperately needs some of that in his office. You have a question, Dave?
Yeah. Dave Zakim, it's good to see you, Steve. Very, very good to see you.
I'm sure it doesn't have anything to do with politics, but I see that the House is castigated by the press for a journeyman signy guy early, yet when the Democrats had the two chambers, and Senator Barron signed the guy early after he passed the budget, that was a brilliant political move that Senator Barron did, but that was immoral what the House did. How come there's a double standard here?
Well, you may have a different recollection than I do, and though I've been in Tallahassee a few years, I wasn't there when Dempsey was Senate President. You may be right. I don't know. I just think that Barron did throw his weight around in a legendary sort of way. But what we saw happen 2 weeks ago was, again, it wasn't a good sign of professional government, and maybe there was a double standard back then. I don't know. The media criticism of the House does strike people as ideological. You don't like Richard Corcoran because he's conservative. That's not it. I mean, I think that but I will say this. The Senate has not done a very good job, because it's so difficult to do. The Senate hasn't done a very good job of messaging and communicating why it is they want to do what they want to do with the general public. They had a big public meeting, a big sort of like a all-day sort of workshop, and it was fairly late in the session. The problem is, it's a difficult issue for the average voter to get their arms around. I mean, how does lip funding relate to Medicaid expansion? You know, then you had the governor draw in the argument that hospitals are making windfall profits at your expense. You know, the hospitals are rich. Don't listen to their, poor mouthing about how they need more money. And the Senate wants to talk about insuring the uninsured. The House and the governor want to talk about rich hospitals. So, to your point. Yes, ma'am, in the back.
Which one?
The young lady in the orange outfit.
Pam Shishon. I've been reading articles online praising Florida for being one of the states that do not allow guns on college campuses. Is this something that our legislature voted on so sensibly, or is this something that happened simply because they didn't vote on it at all? And what else was there in front of the legislature that we may have lucked out on simply because of their inaction?
To your last part of your question, a heck of a lot. inaction, like I said, inaction sometimes is often a good thing. The guns on campus bill got through a couple of committees, but it didn't pass, and a lot of people thought it would pass. But I do think that former Senator John Thrash, who's now at Florida State University, they had a terrible shooting there a few months ago. Almost everybody in Tallahassee has a connection of some kind, either FSU or the University of Florida, in some cases both. Thrasher was a well-regarded legislator, and he made the point, as did, you had university police chiefs, you had other university presidents, and if I have my memory straight, in terms of how that bill actually died mechanically, Senator John, that bill ended up in the committee chaired by Senator John Lay from Pasco County, and he said, I ain't hearing that bill. You know, we laugh about inaction, but one of the effective ways the Florida legislature can stop bad things from happening is you don't need to take an affirmative vote. You just don't do anything. And that's kind of at the heart of the dilemma right now with the healthcare funding situation. The House approach is to basically do nothing. And it's sometimes really difficult to get somebody off dead center and have to proactively make a decision and act. I saw another hand over here. Yes, sir.
Do you think Florida
name.
Ever get
name.
Councilman Newton? That's what I said. Councilman Newton, do you think Florida ever get Medicaid expansion for the millions of people who don't have it?
That's a good question, but I think the answer is no. At the moment, the answer is no. Eventually, I mean, the answer to your question, Councilman, is that elections have consequences. And who gets elected matters. You know, this is an interesting situation for another reason, because 2 years ago, Rick Scott came out for full bore Medicaid expansion. The Senate would describe their plan as a much more pared-down, limited form of Medicaid expansion. The person has to be looking for work. The person has to make co-payments, kind of stuff. And so the governor has moved back from his position. But in order to get Medicaid expansion, you're going to have to get the leadership of the Florida House of Representatives to fundamentally change their position. And the one thing they've said that they've been consistent about is, we are not doing Medicaid expansion, period. Medicaid is a broken system. They're open to the idea of another kind of way to reach these folks. You know, I was having a coffee with a House staff a few days ago, and the person said, we know, Steve Bosquet, the members of the House of Representatives, they hate kids, they hate old people, they hate families. You know, they're very sensitive to the perception of them as being cold-hearted through this whole debate. But people will form their own opinions about that.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Oh, I know you got that. All right. You look pretty good.
My name is Barclay Harless. I worked in the Florida legislature for 4 years, so as a former non-essential state employee, I talked a little bit about Jeb Bush in 2000. What would be your opinion that Jeb Bush in 2000 would be, if he were in office right now, what would be different, given the Medicaid issues?
Well, you might still have a stalemate and a breakdown that we have, because they happened a lot of times when Jeb Bush was governor. But you would have a much more actively engaged governor saying, this is my vision for how I want to solve this problem. I mean, it was Jeb Bush's, misfortune. I mean, he's governor during the presidential recount. He's governor at a time when Johnny Byrd, Speaker of the House, the Johnny Byrd and Jim King relationship, which is 02 to 04, was toxic and dysfunctional. But that would be the difference. Bush would have his sleeves rolled up. He'd be at the table. I remember him saying after he left office, somebody said to him, hey, Jeb, any regrets about being governor? He said, I do have one regret. He said, I sometimes enabled too much bad legislative behavior. That's surprising to hear that. But what Bush was saying is that maybe you got to let these guys fight it out and fix it themselves. They're adults. They're elected officials. They're accountable for what they do. But you would have had, Lord Childs once held up a three-legged stool in the State of the State speech to make the point that he had to deal with the Republican legislature in his last few years, that we're kind of partners in this. We're all in this together. And so I think it would be better for everybody concerned if Rick Scott was sitting at that table. Man on the back.
Thanks for being here, Steve. Ann McMullen with Doyle Wealth Management. when your reports came out about the house shutting down, there were additional reports days later that largely the public didn't care. We are political folks, but largely individuals didn't care. As I was shopping, I talked to folks, didn't know, didn't care. What's the relevancy of the press and the media if folks don't care, don't read? What's the purpose? What's the point then?
Well, I had it with me because I thought, you raise a good point. I mean, it's our job, I believe, to report accurately, fully, comprehensively, continuously. But I can't make people read the articles I write. And I can't make them buy the Tampa Bay Times, which is, as you know, a continuing challenge in this day and age. So, of course, I'm biased. I think the people who live in this community are among the best informed newspaper readers anywhere because the paper cares deeply about what goes on in state government. And it's been a core value of the paper going back to Nelson Pointer and before that. But to the heart of your question, we did something. The editorial board did something that was very controversial during the session. They ran a piece on the editorial page in which they showed mugshots of all of the 13, I think it was, House Republicans who opposed Medicaid expansion. And my colleague and friend, Tim Nickens, used the word immoral. And I said, you're going to hear about that, Nickens. That's pretty strong. And I think what you're seeing in a situation like that is, the best way I can put that would be this. We, at the Times, we in the media, have our own frustrations about how blasé people can be sometimes about the world around them. And this stuff matters, because if the guy living next door to you has no health insurance and has to go to the emergency room instead of being treated by a doctor, that drives up your health insurance figures. I think everybody knows that. And so, that's the answer to that question, is that we all want people to be more engaged, and then the higher voter turnouts. Had a big fight this session over this idea to create an online voter registration form. Big deal. It's still unresolved. It passed overwhelmingly in both chambers, but the Rick Scott's elections official doesn't like it, doesn't want to do it. More people need to get engaged. We're a unique state in that we're almost many of us from somewhere else. And so you have what Bob Graham called the Cincinnati syndrome. People are have more of an affinity to where they grew up than Forest. Now,
Daryl Bowles, 2 years ago, Governor Scott said he could not in good conscience oppose Medicaid expansion because it would serve so many Floridians. So my question to you is, does good conscience turn bad? Did the governor get a bump on the head? Or how do you explain his 180-degree reversal of opinion on Medicaid expansion?
I can't explain it, except if he were standing up here, he would say basically the federal government changed the rules on us, and that's what you get from Rick Scott, is that... He, not only that, you go back one iteration earlier, and there's a flip-flop before he came on to Medicaid expansion. Remember, conservatives for patients' rights, CPR, that was Rick Scott's entree into politics. He had a political action committee that ran ads and raised money to do what? To try to kill Obamacare. Obamacare is a bad idea. A top-down federal government, one-size-fits-all healthcare plan is a terrible idea. It passes anyway. It's upheld by the United States Supreme Court. And after all this effort to kill it, he comes out in favor of Medicaid expansion. I don't have a better explanation. And that's another example of where, you've got to articulate what you're saying, Bartley. You've got to articulate where you're coming from and why you feel the way you do. The single most important thing a governor can do is positively message his agenda on the 6 o'clock news in Tampa. It's vitally important. I don't think this governor does a very good job of it. Yes, sir.
Art O'Hara. I run a very large nonprofit, and if employees just don't show up to work, they either are terminated with no notice, even though our representatives gave us notice, or they're certainly not paid because it's unexcused leave. Why can we not withhold 3 days worth of pay from the House of Representatives? Thank you.
Well, that's an interesting point. If you're talking about nickels and dimes, the joke is Florida legislators make about $28,000 a year, and they're worth every penny of it. But I see your point. They're going to get paid. They in effect get paid overtime. They don't get paid overtime by salary, but somebody just calculated the number. It's about $75,000 a day to hold a special session. Okay, in the context of a state this big, that's not a lot of money. But that's the annual salary of a high school principal or a high school curriculum director. That's real money to people.
Linda Lerner, I know you're not on the editorial board, you're not an opinion writer. I thought the editorial saying what the House is doing is not only immoral, but bad business. What is your personal opinion? Maybe you don't like the word immoral, but do you agree with John Romano's excellent columns and basically what the Times editorial board was saying?
Well, I write columns on occasion, too, and I have to sort of navigate water line between. I cover these folks for a living, and I'm expected to be an honest broker and tell both sides of the story, and I try to do that. You can't work in Tallahassee and not have opinions. I said to Tim Nickens, I said, irresponsible, that's one way to describe what they're doing. Uncaring, when you say someone is guilty of immoral conduct, that puts it in a different. We were having a journalistic conversation about it.
But personally, do you agree with those editorials
without
the immoral in there?
Not necessarily. No, I don't. I don't have an opinion about one way or the other. I mean, I have an opinion that when you are a reporter, you check your opinions, personal opinions at the door. If you'd read my columns, you know I have opinions about kind of the lead style of leadership by this governor, things the legislature is doing. But that's why they pay Tim Nickens to write editorials and not me. I'm the guy covering the news cycle.
I see Kim Black. Many of the House Republican members that I spoke to were blindsided and even expressed embarrassment over the actions in the Senate adjournment. So for the Speaker, their leader, how does he regain their trust and his credibility, or does that even matter anymore, qualities like trust, credibility, loyalty?
They still matter, but the House is a very different place than it used to be. It's a very different place from the Senate. The House is run in a very top-down, hierarchical sort of way. And by the way, Chris Cooley doesn't like Medicaid expansion. Does the name Will Weatherford bring him down? Will Weatherford didn't want Medicaid expansion either. I mean, here's the thing. House members are elected from very small districts. As you know, the districts have been, despite the fair districts, they've been gerrymandering these districts to favor one party or another. And in a place in Orlando or a place in North Central Florida, the election is generally between two Republicans. Okay, it's a pro-Republican district. And so if there's going to be a fight for that seat, it's going to be in a primary. And it's going to be one person as a straightforward, mainstream conservative, and the challenger is even more to the right than the other person. So these folks are constantly worried about being attacked from the right. And if you have a 20% vote in a Republican primary for a House seat, believe it or not, one or two homeowner associations can have a disproportionate effect. That doesn't happen in the Senate race. Senator Lat Ballas, Senator Tom Lee, Arthenia Joyner, they're running in districts that are almost the size of a congressional district. You know, do the math. We have 27 members of Congress and 40 state senators. I mean, as the population of the state grows, we're going to get two or three or four more congressional seats probably in the next decade or so. And so that's at the heart of the problem. And to your point, I've seen it time after time. Senators will openly revolt against leadership. They won't do that in the House. And they won't do that because I guess they're intimidated, they're scared. But it's been this way in the House. Most people who've been around for a while, reporters, lobbyists, staff people, they trace this to Thrasher. John Thrasher was an effective speaker. Thrasher was speaker in 99 and 2000. And he was the first speaker when Jeb Bush got elected governor. Yes, sir, Matt.
This will be the last question.
Harvey Landris. With the House digging in its heels regarding Medicaid expansion, and you several times saying you don't believe it's going to happen, what do you think will happen, the outcome be in the special session? Because you said that, yep, by the 11th hour they will come to some agreement. What is it that they will agree to regarding health care, if anything?
somebody's going to win a little bit and somebody's going to lose a little bit. And if I had to guess and conjecture, they're going to use general revenue money. They're going to use your general revenue tax dollars you pay when you go to Publix or a restaurant. And they're going to use that to try to prop up the low-income pool, the LIP program for hospitals to compensate them for money they spend treating uninsured patients. And there won't be a Medicaid expansion program. But the price of that, what I just described, what they call backfilling the low-income pool with general revenue tax dollars, the casualty in that could be, for example, Rick Scott doesn't get his tax cuts. Or they don't have this, he wants this quote-unquote record funding for K-12 education, which isn't really a record when you factor in population growth and inflation and other things. It's true that it's a bigger bottom line number. So everybody's going to win, everybody's going to lose. And that's the only way out of this situation. There's been a complete breakdown here of mutual respect, and being able to sit down and sort of hammer something out. It sounds nakedly political, and it is, but the idea that we're going to sit down and compromise, and you get some of what you want, and I get some of what I want, and we shake hands, and we try to present this to the public as a reasonable solution to an intractable problem. That's it. Thank you so much for your questions.
Thank you. Thank you.
Present you with our highly sought after mug, Carbo Politician for Lunch. And remind people that June 11th, we have a Galtieri back at the Yacht Club. And we have a winner, I'm sure, somewhere. We're going to present the tiger to Fangin Follower. Here we go. Thank you. Well, we'll see. There are some good questions in there. Okay. And the winner for the question, how does the speaker win trust back from the rest of the House? Kim Black. Perfect.
Crazy the way you say.